the political splits are becoming more class-oriented and less racially based. But I have to say, I don't really trust that that long-term is going to come into view at the moment. It's extremely hard to look past November the 5th. Nobody does. The discussion about what Biden would do in a second term would, in an ordinary political cycle, now be an ordinary discussion. It would be a commonplace one to have. It's just not happening because nobody can see past that existential date. And we do know that whatever happens on that date, the side that loses, and that could apply to either side, will see the result as illegitimate. And I think that's pretty much a given. And that sort of zero-sum existentialism is just something you don't find in any other democracy.
And now, The Good Fight with Yascha Monk.
As my guest Ed Luys and I briefly discuss on the podcast this week, it feels like the upcoming presidential election is a slow-moving train wreck. We see the trains speeding towards each other. We know that there's a very significant likelihood of Donald Trump being re-elected president of the United States, and yet nobody quite seems to have a plan of what to do about it. For a long time, people were understating concerns about Joe Biden's physical and mental acuity. Now there's a much more open discussion about the topic, but it is probably too late to substitute him at the top of the ticket, and it's unclear that any other Democrat would wind up being that much more popular in any case. Certainly, his vice president is less popular than him. More broadly, though, there is also little attempt to shape the themes and the tone of this election. For a while, the Biden campaign tried to emphasize how wonderful the economy is, trying to persuade voters that they are misjudging the state of the world. They have somehow toned down those attempts. It is hard to know what the core theme of Biden's re-election bid is at this point. I think that there is one thing that, whether it is Joe Biden or some other candidate, the party can still do to increase its chances of beating Donald Trump in November of 2024. And that is to clearly distance the party from the left fringe, both of elected Democratic politicians and more broadly of the very loud minority of people influencing much of American culture. There are a lot of swing voters. According to many of the recent polls, Democrats are losing among working class Hispanics, among all Hispanics, a head-to-head matchup with Trump. There are millions of people who voted for Biden in 2020, but are now worried that with Biden himself diminished and the people around him more progressive than they are comfortable with, the country is going to drift in the wrong direction. I think that Joe Biden can and should follow the example of British political leader Keir Starmer in drawing a clear line between himself and that left fringe. That wouldn't radically transform the electoral prospects of a Democratic Party. It might lose him a few votes, as well as win him a good number of votes. But I think it is the most realistic path towards re-election. The alternative, which Democrats currently seem to be set on, is to try and keep together the broadest possible coalition, because they're both really scared about losing progressive voters on the left who might defect to a third-party candidate like Cornel West, or moderate voters in the middle who might go back to Donald Trump or vote for a no-labels moderate candidate. But if they don't decide one way or the other, if they don't go for fish or for fowl, they might end up not winning both, but losing both, and that would hand the White House to Donald Trump. My guest today is Ed Luys. Ed is the chief U.S. political commentator and columnist for the Financial Times and the author of a number of really interesting books, including The Retreat of Western Liberalism. And he is now at work on the first biography of Zbyk Brzezinski, which we briefly touched upon. But mostly, we did a tour d'horizon of America in 2024, trying to figure out why the country feels so broken at the moment, at a political level, but also the social and cultural level. How it can be that our upcoming election most likely will again consist in a contest between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and why it is that Trump, according to most recent polls, seems to be leading in that contest. Ed Luce, welcome back to the podcast.
Delighted to be here, Yasha.
One of the things I really appreciate about your view about the world, but particularly on America, is that you're kind of insider-outsider. You are a Brit. You are trained in some ways as a foreign correspondent. But you've lived in the United States for long enough now that you know the country extremely, extremely well. What strikes me about the United States at the moment, even in comparison to Europe, which has severe and serious problems of its own, is just a general sense of malaise, a general sense of things not quite working as they should, of a social fabric not quite holding together. What's your impression of living in the United States in 2024?
That's a really good question, because I mean, if you look at all the sort of old-fashioned, what I call 20th century indicators, that America ought to be a better place to be living in, particularly somebody in my relatively fortunate position than Europe. The economic numbers are much better. The unemployment numbers are much lower. The sort of technological innovation perspective is much better. So, you know, just on those objective measures, America is a better place to live in, but it just doesn't feel like it.
One of the striking things when we compare the United States to Europe is that Europe's share of global GDP has considerably shrunk over the last 25, 30 years. America is where it was 25 or 30 years ago, right? Which is an amazing accomplishment given the rise of China and other countries in Asia and so on.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I think there's been a sort of rather technical debate about, you know, how you value Europe, because it's partly the euro-dollar exchange rate and that fluctuates. But for sure, relative share of Europe has dropped and America is constant. The sort of intangible, anecdotal feeling I have, and a lot of friends, and I'd be interested to see if you agree too, a lot of friends say the same thing, is that when you get off the plane from America and land in Europe, wherever you're landing, even in Britain, which has had pretty fraught politics, you just exhale a little bit. You relax a little bit. There is less tension. There is less of a sort of existential sort of foreboding in your system when you're outside of America than when you get back. And by the same token, when you get back, you tense up a little bit. There's a deep sort of feeling of tension to everyday life in America that just wasn't true when I first moved here, which is now quite a long time ago. And there are many reasons for it, but I think the sort of chief one is that politics is existential and it is deeply, deeply evenly split, deep and even, and not shifting very much. You know, that you don't get wild gyrations in people's, they don't seem to be performance related. They seem to be identity based, their political loyalties. And that just creates a serious feeling of uneasiness about what America is and how long it will remain so.
I have two questions about that. The first is a genuine question, which is to say that I'm unsure as to the answer. The second is perhaps a little bit more of a challenge. Perhaps we have a slight disagreement there. So on the first one, do you think that the tension is in our head for those of us who really care about politics? Do you think that people writing about politics in New York and DC and so on feel that when we step off a plane? Or do you think it also pervades everyday American life? If you go to a suburb of Cleveland, do you think that people also feel that there's some tension, some form of mistrust, some form of fear that wouldn't have been there 15 or 20 years ago? That's a genuine question. I'm unsure about that. I think it's plausible to think that tension has increased everywhere, but I don't quite trust myself to know the answer. The second question is about the even split in our society. Because one way to look at the even split is to say, the 2016 elections were very close. The 2020 elections were pretty close. It looks like the 2024 election might be pretty close for Donald Trump, according to the latest polls, has a significant lead. And so therefore, you know, you have the same two teams just entrenched, battling it out each time. But of course, we are seeing some rather remarkable movement in who is a member of each of the teams. So from 2020 to 2016, Biden significantly improved his performance among white voters. Trump significantly improved his performance among non-white voters. According to some of the polls for 2024, including one recent poll in the New York Times, it now looks like a majority of Hispanics is going to vote for Donald Trump. And the number of African-Americans who are going to vote for Trump has increased by something like an order of threefold compared to where Obama was in 2008 and 2012. There's a weird thing there where, you know, what you're saying is technically right, but there is this deep division and it's very close. But there is actually movement between the teams to a larger extent than that perhaps would suggest.
Your first question, my answer is, you know, always comes with a health warning, which is that if you're living in Washington, D.C., and, you know, you engage on sites like X, Twitter, you're getting a very refracted and a very untypical perspective on what politics is like for most Americans. So, I mean, that's always got to be discounted in the price of whatever I say. But that having been said, the degree to which all Americans now consume algorithmically directed news that confirms their prejudices and stokes their outrage about, you know, often completely cartoonish representations of what the other side are about, is off the charts compared to 15 years ago, where it's a completely different universe of media consumption. And whilst I appreciate there is an exhausted majority who don't consume much politics, the sort of delta there of people who do, which is a significant minority of America, and the way they've changed and biased, perhaps consciously or maybe unconsciously, their media habits into one that's more about enmity than it is about rivalry. I don't think that can be overstated. I think that that is a big change. And I do think, therefore, that the what I feel, even though it's a very sort of exaggerated version of that, being a beltway creature, that does find echo in broader society, American society as a whole.
My sense on the first question is, but I think that's where my hunch is as well. I have low confidence in that statement, but I think that is the statement I would find to be most probable as well. What about the second question?
Second question's a more difficult one, and it's a very good question, because you're right, there is movement, particularly amongst blue-collar voters. There is movement of non-white, working-class voters to the Trump banner. I'm not sure we're going to see in 2024, whatever the outcome is, Biden retaining that higher white blue-collar, white working-class vote that he got over what Hillary Clinton had in 2016. I think the numbers suggest that all working-class are drifting more towards the Republican, towards the MAGA banner. That kind of undercuts, as you say, the idea that there's a deep, crisp and even split between the two Americas. But nevertheless, there is, even if there are movements underneath it, there is a 50-50 nature to America. Some of that is made up for by more and more women, and particularly college-educated people of all colors, moving to the Democratic banner. And over the long term, what I would say is that is a good thing, because the political splits are becoming more class-oriented and less racially based. But I have to say, I don't really trust that long term is going to come into view at the moment. It's extremely hard to look past November the 5th. Nobody does. The discussion about what Biden would do in a second term would, in an ordinary political cycle, now be an ordinary discussion. It would be a commonplace one to have. It's just not happening, because nobody can see past that existential date. And we do know that whatever happens on that date, the side that loses, and that could apply to either side, will see the result as illegitimate. And I think that's pretty much a given. And that sort of zero-sum existentialism is just something you don't find in any other democracy.
Yeah, I've been saying for a little while now that the one thing that all Americans can agree on is that American democracy is in deep danger. Republicans, or followers of Donald Trump in any case, say that because they think that the 2020 election was stolen from them. Democrats say that because they fear what Donald Trump has done in office in his first term. They are shocked and horrified by January the 6th, 2021, and they worry about what he's going to do in his second term in office. You know, I guess it is a deeply divided country, fall into one of these camps rather than the other. But it's this remarkable fact that we sort of agree on that diagnosis as Americans, even as we disagree fundamentally about the reasons for that diagnosis. It's a very strange state of affairs. I want to pick up on something you said about class, because you said, look, I mean, you know, perhaps it's good that our politics are coming to center more around class than about race. And I agree with that. I mean, the sort of vision in which it's something positive that Democrats would have this inevitable majority because non-white people would all vote for the Democratic Party or in great majorities vote for the Democratic Party always struck me as rather dystopian, because A, permanent majority is bad in a democracy, and B, I don't want to live in a country where I can look at somebody's skin color and know who they're voting for. That sounds actually like a recipe for deep social divisions that are very dangerous. So there's a positive element to that. But there's a strange aspect to the class story, and that is one that America does share with other countries, even as there's important differences in other areas. Namely, that suddenly it is the right-wing party that is becoming the party of a working class, at least to a greater extent than it was previously. And it is the left-wing party that is becoming the party that in many ways is naturally at home among the old bourgeoisie. That is going on in the United States, but it has also happened in many European countries and elsewhere. What explains that, and what does that say about the extent to which the American story is shared with other countries or distinct from it?
A lot of that is shared with other countries. I mean, just to pick a couple of examples, Britain. Although Britain is about to belie that, you know, with its next general election. I mean, I think all classes and all races are going to vote against the Conservative Party. We're seeing a potential sort of 1997 level wipeout there. But hitherto, up until now, yes, the right in Britain has been capturing a larger and larger share of the working classes. The right in France has been capturing a larger and larger share of the working classes. And that's very similar to the picture in the United States. It's much more worrying than if it were the other way around, than that the right was the party of the educated and the college elite, and the left were, as traditionally has been the case, the blue-collar, union-driven representative political group. Because when you get the right on cultural, the working class on cultural issues to come under the right's banner, that does mean that politics is more about working class culture than it is about working class economics. The debate amongst Democrats about why Americans aren't feeling better about their economic prospects and why they're not expressing that more with higher approval ratings for Biden is a fascinating one to watch, because what you're seeing and hearing is very educated people, journalists, academics, DNC consultants, and so forth, saying you should be feeling happy, but you're not feeling happy, which strikes me as a very bad political strategy to say you're wrong. The starting point of your objection is false. And I think there's a couple of reasons why this is happening. One, we underestimate just how big that inflation leap was. And over and above that, it's not just inflation. We talk technically about how the consumer price index is measured, but the consumer price index doesn't include interest rates. And people experience higher interest rates as inflation, even if it isn't technically defined as inflation. Their mortgage rates have gone right up. Housing's become unaffordable. The auto loan has, you know, leapt from $600 a month to $850 a month. That is felt as inflation. So that's one point.
The other very brief point on inflation, Ed, I think I may have said this on the podcast before, is the economic measure of inflation is comparing this year, sort of today, to a year ago. But that's not how people think about it, right? They go to the supermarket and think, well, you know, I used to pay $4.99 for this, and now I'm paying $6.99 for this. The fact that last year they paid $6.69 for it isn't what's salient in my mind. What's salient in my mind is that 5 years ago they paid $4.99 for it. So even as inflation has, in fact, come under control to a considerable extent, the comparison that people make is not the one that the economic data makes.
That isn't. You're quite right. And, you know, it's a matter of debate amongst economists what the sort of temporal sheet is in terms of how long that sticker shock dating from the end of the pandemic becomes normalized in their heads and ceases to be a shock. I mean, another part of this debate is that Trump, you know, pretty much all objective measures would be worse for inflation than Biden. Cutting off immigration, putting a 10% tariff on all imports, you know, it's a direct tax on the middle class. And then the anti-globalization agenda, all of which splits up markets and raises the cost of production and therefore will be more inflationary. All of these are serenely sort of settled and concluded in Democrats' favor by highly educated people, have zero impact on the perceptions of the working classes who are flocking to Trump's banner. Now, why are they flocking to Trump's banner? I mean, I think partly it's that they do remember not January the 6th, not Trump's sort of nonsensical commentary about how you cure COVID. They do remember a big boost to real wages for the middle classes, to their own pocketbook, during Trump's first 3 years. That's one thing. And under Biden, they felt a certain austerity that is only now beginning to ease. Two, though, is to go back to our first question. If you are getting your news from the particular sort of echo chamber that presents Biden as hopeless and as aging and senile and a world going out of control and polycrisis, etc., including the border being open, then, you know, no amount of good data is going to dissuade you from what is a partisan filter about the economy. And there's been a lot of research on this. Consumer sentiment indexes are no longer very, very trustworthy because people filter how they feel through a partisan lens in a way they just didn't do 10 years ago.
So we're slowly approaching the meat of what any sort of tour d'horizon, and I think this is a tour d'horizon conversation in 2024 has to do, which is to actually discuss the upcoming presidential election and to try and explain why it is that it looks like a rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump and why it is that in current polls, Donald Trump is ahead in battleground states and ahead in the national polls. Now, in a way, I think when you think about Trump, it again complicates this idea that there's two teams, because you are right that there is this partisan media echo chamber in which Trump can't do very much wrong and blames Biden and the Democrats for everything that's wrong with America today and so on and so forth. But it's not 50% of the population. It's not even 50% of voters who are part of that media bubble. And one of the striking things is that Donald Trump is unpopular in the American population. I just looked up his current favorability rating, and, you know, according to 538, you know, his unfavorability is about 52% and his favorability at about 43 or 44%. That's not a huge gap, but it's a significant gap. And of course, a lot of the people who view him unfavorably view him very unfavorably. So there is this kind of key part of the electorate that actually views both Biden and Trump unfavorably. And there's an even broader part of the electorate that perhaps says, oh, I have a kind of favorable opinion of one or the other or of both. But in the end, when push comes to shove, I'm going to vote for Trump. And that seems to me like the people who will determine in significant part this upcoming election. And I'm having trouble quite putting my finger on what they're thinking, right? Like, we know why the hardcore MAGA fan who is on Truth Social and watches Newsmax is going to vote for Trump. I think that's in a way a less interesting question. Why is the person who doesn't like Trump actually has real skepticism towards him, is perhaps even concerned about what happened on January 6th and so on, why are they looking at the Democrats and at Biden and saying, you know what, the alternative is so bad, I'm gonna pull the trigger for Trump after all?
It's a very good question, and I suspect there are 1,000 answers to it that relate to different groups, different economic circumstances, different age, and you'll get different answers from everybody. You know, whenever I'm sort of traveling outside of Washington and talking to people, I always sort of start on the expectation I'm going to end this trip with a narrative of what Americans think, and I always end it more confused than when I begin, because there isn't a simple narrative. I think that the reasons people would vote for Trump, even knowing that he's a threat to democracy, even knowing about January the 6th, relate to this relentless sort of imagery of Biden as being old and incompetent And your idea of a chief executive is what you're partly voting for maybe mainly voting for in a presidential election. Your image of a chief executive is hugely important to how you vote. Do you see that person as able to take tough decisions, as being wakeable at 3 a.m., etc.? All the cliches you think about a commander-in-chief are true, I think, when it comes to voters deciding in their gut who should be president. And it is an unfortunate fact that even though I think, objectively speaking, Biden shows fewer signs of cognitive decline than Trump, that Trump appears more animalistic and fit physically, which is where you get your impressions from, your images from. Biden does look, because he is, more frail physically, both than he was a few years ago, but also than Trump is today. And that disproportionately affects your idea of the vitality of a commander-in-chief. Remember, in 2020, Biden didn't campaign much in the great outdoors of America because it was a pandemic. So he was able to do it from Delaware mostly. This time, the only solution to what is the overwhelming 3/4 of Americans, and that includes half of Democrats, believe he's too old to do the job. The only possible answer to that comes from Biden physically being on the stump. There is no surrogate who can assuage that problem. And so Biden has to be vigorous, seen to be vigorous, ubiquitous, and, you know, I'm not sure he's got that in him.
I'm struck what you were saying with more signs of cognitive decline in Donald Trump than in Joe Biden. Explain to us why that is. And separately, you're living in Washington, D.C., you're very well connected. What are you hearing privately, you know, on background, about how alert and vigorous Joe Biden is? One line I've heard from a number of people is, well, you know, he's better in the mornings than the afternoons or the evenings, and kind of euphemistic phrases like that. I mean, what is it you're hearing privately about Joe Biden from people who are working with him? And why is it that you think that there's more signs of cognitive decline in Donald Trump than in Biden?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing privately, I mean, anecdotally from people who work with Biden or go in and see him, is he's just as sort of clear in his own mind and able to articulate his preferences and his views, whether we agree with them or not, whether, you know, they're classic Biden's examples of his stubbornness, as you might be seeing with Israel at the moment with the Gaza Strip, but that Biden is sort of no more or less articulate than he's been in the past. He's never been articulate. He's always had, you know, what they call logorrhea, which is seeking for words that substitute for ones he stutters over. And so he's always been inarticulate. He's less long-winded than he used to be because he is older and tireder and perhaps a bit busier. And his schedule, daily schedule, you know, is a shorter version of what it was when he was vice president. There's no doubt that he's older and has less energy, but that there's no signs of cognitive decline.
Let me push you on that for a moment, Ed. I mean, I'm certainly not a doctor and I'm not one of a camp that is saying he clearly has dementia or something like that. But people his age, 80, you know, people, octogenarians, fall along a broad range of cognitive ability. And I don't know that we would want the average 80-year-old to run the country in terms of sort of where they are on the cognitive scale. And the average 80-year-old certainly is cognitively somewhat less with it than the average 73 or 74-year-old. There's a significant decline that happens in those years for most people, right? We know that from all kinds of research. To me, it does feel that if I compare not just Biden's physical condition, which obviously has declined, he's frail in a way he wasn't as a vice president, but, you know, the frequency with which he talks about Iraq when he means to talk about Ukraine or makes those kind of lapses, the sort of senior moments when he just looks startled and he's like really searching for words and there's an uncomfortable silence of a number of seconds. I don't remember that from the past. I mean, he's always, you know, he's never had the reputation of being the Hill's greatest intellectual. He's always had a reputation for gaffes, some of which were winning because he kind of said what he actually thought rather than giving the politic answer. Famously, there was the case of gay marriage, for example. But that seems to me sort of like a different set of concerns that we have now relative to then.
There's two things I'd say to that. One is maybe I should be a bit more precise with my language. There are no signs of dementia or senility. Sure, there is cognitive decline in the sense that he's slower than he used to be, and perhaps his memory isn't as good as it used to be. Maybe that overlaps with early onset dementia, I don't know. But the people who interact with him say that he's on top of the agenda. And these are people, you know, who are not necessarily inclined to big him up and to be boosterish. So I'm persuaded that he's not in sort of some early stage of senility yet, or that the signs aren't visible. I am persuaded that 4 more years of president, we could have a Reagan second term situation where he very much is. And that to me, again, it sort of relates to, we're not talking about what happens after November the 5th. And what happens after November the 5th, if Biden wins, is that Biden has 4 more years as president. Now, if he's already tired and showing signs of flagging in his towards the end of his first term, the second term's going to be a serious trial. It's going to be a wake for Biden's political exit almost from day one. And that, you know, that is to me an under debated element on the Democratic side. And I don't expect that because it's so brittle, the political debate right now. I don't expect that's going to be given much airtime, but it's a serious concern. Trump's signs of cognitive decline, he didn't used to forget like he's been forgetting. So, you know, his almost routine now, messing up of names and confusion of who he's fighting. Is it Obama he's fighting against? His inability to articulate words that have more than 2 or 3 syllables from his prompt. This is something that we weren't seeing 4 years ago to nearly this extent. And we ought to be debating, you know, that just as much. But as I say, because of his sort of physical primal, sort of animalistic impression, we're not. It's just not registering to the same degree amongst voters. But it's just as real. If Biden had said that he was fighting Romney or somebody on the stump, as Trump said he was fighting Obama, the media would have made a lot more of a fuss about it than it did.
So to me, the whole election has felt like a train wreck that everybody is seeing coming from a mile away and not doing anything about, right? It's been clear for a long time that Joe Biden is really quite unpopular. You know, it's been clear for a while that Trump would turn out to be competitive. And everybody is sort of mesmerized by the possibility of Trump winning again and looking at that in fear, in some ways falling into line. I mean, I found it interesting that journalists were very reluctant to speak about Biden's age, you know, through the fall. And now suddenly, when it's kind of too late to do anything about it, there is a much more frank discussion about the issue than there has been hush-hush in the last few years. But still, nobody seems to have a plan about what to do. And it strikes me that, you know, senior Democratic figures, the White House, the Biden campaign seem to basically be thinking, you know, we're going to keep barreling forward. And even though it looks like we're about to have a train crash, something will save us. What do you think, if anything, Democrats can do at this point to improve their chances of victory? Does Biden need to change how he campaigns? Does he need to change his political posture? Does he need to embrace policies he hasn't? Is there anything the Democrats can do other than just sort of the very bread and butter business of running a presidential campaign without a very clear message that they've been sort of going through that might change the likely outcome of this electoral season?
Yeah, I think that what they assume, and I share some of this, what the Biden campaign assumes is that most American people are not paying attention. I mean, here is, you know, the Beltway refraction. The last place you want to test American public opinion is living in Washington, D.C. This is the last place to know what people are feeling. They're not obsessed with Supreme Court stays on immunity hearings or Colorado expedited hearings. They're just not following this stuff. They might sort of pay attention to the Stormy Daniels, but basically they're tuned out unless they're sort of fanatics and not paying attention. And that's always been true. And in this sense, it's a normal election year. They will start paying attention to a much greater degree from July, August onwards when the conventions start, and particularly from Labor Day. So I think the Biden campaign is right that people are just not paying enough attention to the fact that Trump could be the next president again. And Trump is hated by a majority of America. It's not an overwhelming majority, but it is more than 50% fear and hate him in what to one degree or another. And that just needs to be activated. He is a turnout machine for Democrats like no other. We saw that in 2020, the highest turnout in American history. The highest absolute numbers of votes in American history, one of the highest turnouts in decades. We saw that in the midterms in 2022, when a lot of Trumpian endorsed candidates produced a turnout against them and they lost, and their famed red wave didn't break. So their assumption is third time same as the first two, 2020, 2022, 2024. And there is some grounds for thinking that is reasonable, that the polls are underweighting Biden right now. And I think that there's some grounds of that. What makes me nervous is perhaps because I'm a Brit, I think of David Cameron. I think, well, he won the Scottish referendum. Then he won the general election. So he thought, let's just roll the dice. We keep winning. Let's just keep the message the same, which is carry on. Grown-ups are in charge, business as usual, and have a Brexit referendum. And we saw what happened then. I'm worried that there is too much complacency and serenity in the Biden campaign. And what they ought to be doing is two things. One is Biden's got to be out there. He has to be out there. The overwhelming issue, as we discussed earlier, is his age and competence. There's only one way to counter that. The second, and this is not in his power, is to pray and hope next to his bed, kneel by his bed every night and pray that Jay Powell and the U.S. Federal Reserve start cutting interest rates, because nothing would better and more quickly feed through to a sense of consumer well-being than lower interest rates. Nothing that Biden can do to influence that. If he were Trump, he'd be trying to browbeat Jay Powell into doing what he wants. But no single economic gauge could be more effective more quickly than monetary easing.
I broadly agree with what you're saying, and I think there's a lot in that. My concern about the theory that these past electoral results will translate into another electoral result in 2024 is twofold, right? First, that there used to be a conventional wisdom in American politics that Republicans are favored in midterm elections. That made sense in part because people who are more affluent and more educated tend to vote in higher numbers, particularly in less important elections like midterms. And Republicans were overrepresented among the college educated and so on, right? That has been changing as we've been discussing. And as Republicans become the working class party to some extent, Democrats rely more strongly among college educated voters, as well as certain special interest groups that are very effective at driving people to the polls, like teachers unions. The earlier Republican advantage in midterm elections has been substituted by a Democratic advantage. That, I think, helps to explain why 2022 went slightly differently when people fought, as well as some small elections in 23 and 21 and so on. When it comes to 2020, we were in the middle of a pandemic, which was a problem for incumbents in many countries. And Joe Biden was the untested alternative, the reliable, steady hand at the tiller, known quantity, not very scary untested alternative, but the person in whom everybody could project their hopes and their preferences and their dreams, as is often the case with somebody who is an opposition leader rather than somebody who's in government and being judged on people's perception of how the country is going. And so I don't know sort of how much we can rely on 2020 as a precedent for 2024 for that reason. The other thing I'd say is that there is a kind of concern about the interaction effect between Biden's age and the general perception of the Democratic Party, or perhaps even the general perception of the American establishment. I think one of the reasons why Joe Biden's age is an issue is that people think, well, very easily his vice president might ascend to the presidency, and Kamala Harris is less popular than Joe Biden. But even more broadly, I think there's a perception that people have that the Democratic Party and its allied media and other institutions are way out of the American mainstream. One poll that I keep going back to is that more Americans think that the Democratic Party is too extreme than think that the Republican Party is too extreme. Now, they didn't think that about Joe Biden. And in 2020, he seemed vigorous enough that they said, well, Biden, you know, I've become quite skeptical of Democrats, but Biden I can live with. You know, he's an old-style Democrat. He cares about working people. As long as he's there, I'm not that scared of the general movement of a Democratic Party. I wonder whether now they're saying, look, Biden's all right. I feel sorry for him. I don't think he's very effective. I don't hate him. I think relatively few Americans hate Joe Biden. But I don't know that he's in charge. I don't know that he's going to be charged in the next 4 years. And the Democratic Party is just too far away from my values. I don't trust them. I don't trust him to stand up for me if I need him to stand up for me. I don't trust him to actually care about people like me. And that produces, in my mind, the temptation to say, look, I don't like Trump either, but faced with this shitty choice, perhaps that's what I should do. And that, it seems to me, something the Democrats could do something about. You alluded briefly to Keir Starmer's big lead in the opinion polls in the United Kingdom. Of course, that is in part because the Conservative Party has been in power for a very long time and done a very bad job of it and is now deeply unpopular. But it is in part because Keir Starmer has actually cut off the left of his party and thereby demonstrated to people who haven't always voted Labour that they can trust him, that they don't have to be afraid of him in government. I do wonder whether the one thing that the Democrats and the Biden campaign could do, that they've been sort of slightly playing with it, but they haven't really done it, is to just make it clear that the left of the party or even the opinion page of the New York Times doesn't represent Joe Biden and doesn't represent what's going to happen over the next 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk, of course, of nowadays of a Snapchat, TikTok campaign. You need to reach the young. And, you know, Biden can be a nice grand parental, sort of quite self-deprecating presence that could win over some young people. Cannot help but remember him giving what became a notorious TikTok interview to a very well-known, amongst that generation, transgender woman. You know, at a time when he wasn't and he still isn't giving real interviews to real newspapers. That kind of virtue signaling, I think, is not confined to the target audience. It gets noticed nationally, picked up and then magnified by Fox and others and One America Network. And he's given the impression that Biden is, he might not be an ultra woke person himself, but he's highly tolerant of wokeness. And I think that that's, you know, even more reinforced by the image that Kamala Harris has. I agree. It plays a heavy role in a lot of voters' minds about what is extreme and what is not extreme. And some of the cultural positions of the progressives in America are considered to be extreme, even if they find no sort of legislative manifestation in Capitol Hill in Washington. The whole sort of language and vocabulary is perceived to be something all Democrats support to one degree or another. So a sister soldier moment, or a series of sister soldier moments, which indicates, no, we are grown up here, we get your concerns, I think would be highly merited. You know, I don't know whether, you know, Keir Starmer had a bit more of a gift there, which is an ex-leader who was an extremist, Jeremy Corbyn, who was surrounded by, you know, even more extreme people and anti-Semites. And it's quite easy to purge because they were a defeated predecessor. It's a bit more difficult in a federal and continental democracy like this to do that. And so the time to start would be now. And I agree with it. It's an important thing. You've got to be culturally moderate, economically progressive. And I keep fearing that the Democrats are getting that inside out. They're dismissing people's economic concerns and accentuating cultural positions, even if it's not Biden himself doing it. the impression is that that's the party as a whole. And so he has to distance himself. And that could be part of the, you know, the vigor, the returned vigor of Trump, of Biden on the hustings. One other thing that's really important is that opinion polls have shown that a lot of people who are considering voting for Trump would change their mind if he were convicted, if he had a criminal conviction. The Supreme Court's basically just taken that away. Now, we can speculate as to a conspiratorial element of that. I think it's a really simple question that there are six Republicans on the court and three Democrats, and they tend on these issues to vote with their party, regardless of what judicial language they skillfully dress it up in. And therefore, what we have is a one potentially massive game changer removed from the equation between now and November. It's very, very unlikely any verdict is now possible, either for the January 6th trial, or indeed, although this is quite separate to the Supreme Court immunity decision, from the Georgia election interference trial. And then, of course, we have a Trump-appointed judge, a Judge Cannon in Florida for the classified documents. All three of the serious criminal trials now are basically post-November, at which point, if Trump won, he could shut them down. That is political obstruction by the Supreme Court. A very, very serious, potentially game-changing nature.
Let me challenge you on that a little bit. I've been struck by the extent to which the Supreme Court hasn't done Donald Trump's bidding over the course of the last years. Certainly, it has taken deeply conservative decisions that are in keeping with the longstanding goals of the conservative legal movement, particularly when you think about something like the overturning of Roe versus Wade. But when it has come to issues that really were about helping Trump or the MAGA movement, as opposed to making rulings which are in accordance with the legal philosophy that the conservative movement has held for a good number of decades, I think the record is quite different. In 2020, there was many lawsuits that the Trump campaign filed, and both in a number of Texas courts, where I remember at the time many people were predicting these judges who were appointed by Trump, who were extremely conservative, were going to grant some of his motions. They were just universally quashed. And of course, the Supreme Court decided not to come to Trump's rescue. So in light of that, I wonder whether we should give a little bit more grace to the current decision of the Supreme Court and say, look, the question of whether or not the president should enjoy immunity is an incredibly important question that the Supreme Court should consider. I should expect that the Supreme Court comes down on the side of Trump not having this immunity, and I would be saddened if they rule in a different way. But the fact that that is the kind of question that the Supreme Court should consider and settle doesn't seem to me to be obtruse. And then there's an argument to be made that, you know, an upcoming election shouldn't factor into that decision to take the case one way or the other, that the Supreme Court should decide that on the merits without sort of looking in one way or the other of which political candidate that might favor or disfavor. So I know there's arguments on the other side, but I want you to sort of defend that suspicion you have that there really was a political interest at stake here.
I think you put the best possible gloss on what the Supreme Court has done. I mean, I have no doubt, in keeping with what you cited from 2020, that when it comes to their ruling on this, the opinion will be a majority in favor of saying that the president doesn't have blanket immunity for actions taken in office. So I don't doubt that the Supreme Court is not going to produce a crazy ruling. It won't. There might be some twists in there we can't anticipate. The key thing about this is timing. The Supreme Court can hear anything at any point under emergency. It can set its own timetable. It has to complete carte blanche to do so. The special counsel, Jack Smith, asked them in December to expedite, because of the political timetable, the hearing to the immunity appeal that the Trump lawyers had submitted. They said no, it should be heard by the Federal Appeals Court in the District of Columbia, which then produced a unanimous and very scathing judgment on the Trump team's argument that a president could use Navy SEAL 6 teams to assassinate political rivals, that he could basically do anything. It was a really clear open and shut, at which point the Supreme Court could have said, well, that's enough. or but we will hear it, but we will hear it quickly. Instead, what it did was it chose to hear it the last possible date in its term, which is April the 22nd, which puts a stay on all federal trials of Trump and means there won't be a ruling until late June, possibly early July, that the court case at the very earliest can't start till August. And because of the Department of Justice rule that you don't hear materially political cases within 60 days of an election, this will almost certainly not start until after November. Or if it does start before November, 99% sure you won't get a verdict before then, at which point he shuts down the trial if he wins. So I think this is sophisticated but blatant political interference. I think it's political obstruction, and it's through time, not the substance of what they would ultimately rule, but through time.
Final question on this electoral stuff before I want to ask you a little bit about what you've been thinking about for the last few years, which is both related and rather different. What's the second Trump term going to look like in America and in the world? How worried should we be?
The Project 2025 is worth reading. This is the heritage-led sort of mass, sort of conservative think tank, crowdsourced plan for the next Republican president. They don't specify Trump, but it's clearly for Trump. It wouldn't work for, say, a Nikki Haley. And the last time they did this was in 1980 with Reagan. And Reagan came in and he implemented about 70% of what was in the document. He hadn't, you know, being Reagan, done deep sort of dive policy thinking. He had certain precepts and philosophical, you know, stances, but he wasn't a policy wonk, and Heritage did it for him and he implemented most of it. And so I think Trump is not that dissimilar. He has instincts. He has personal agendas. He's very dissimilar to Reagan in other respects, but he is unprepared and he will take this off the shelf. And what it suggests is, well, from a Financial Times point of view, very much doubling down on the anti-globalization. I mean, really sort of clear policies there for having a much more protectionist America, having a more of a fortress America in terms of immigration, federalizing National Guards to have mass deportations, and, you know, building and funding the detention centers to round them up. I think all of these to some degree or another will happen. Whether Trump will formally withdraw from NATO is, I think, almost a red herring. He would, by declaring Article 5, which, you know, you come to the aid of fellow members of NATO, to be essentially conditional on whether a country's spending money, enough money on defense, it will deprive the NATO core principle, core article of its vitality. So NATO will de facto die under Trump. I'm not sure he would start wars. The only one I sort of really fear is Iran. I think the results will be terrible for the West. I don't think they'll be quite so sort of roiling of global stability as people might fear. The fear I have is for American democracy. And I think there's a very clear plan there. There are personnel available. There won't be adults put, as in 2016, adults put in. There won't be, people like Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State or General Kelly as Chief of Staff. You might get Steve Mnuchin type again at Treasury, but basically you'll get hardcore Trumpians who believe in the agenda, like Rick Grenell, Kash Patel. Steve Bannon's come way back into favor, incidentally. Maybe he would have a role again. You will have hardcore Trumpians from day one with a plan this time. Remember in 2016, nobody had a plan. Nobody was expecting this. This time there will be a fairly fleshed out Trumpianism. And I think the sort of auguries for American democracy, for the republic stability, would be very dark.
We're going to make a, not a 180-degree turn, but say a 120-degree turn. You have been hard at work, I know, on a biography of Zbigniew Brzeziński, the very influential American Polish diplomat and political scientist who was national security advisor under President Carter. I don't want to go too much into the details because, of course, we'll have you back on the podcast at when the book comes out. But why a biography of Brzeziński? Why is he worthy of tremendous effort by one of our most insightful writers and journalists? And how does he speak to this moment? Why is it that we should care to understand about Brzezinski's life, his triumphs and his failures?
Oh, well, thank you for asking, and a very good question. I mean, you know, his great rival was Henry Kissinger, and Kissinger cooperated with a lot of biographies, and there's still one ongoing by Neil Ferguson, and wrote, of course, a lot of autobiographies. He had a good sense of humor, Kissinger. He said, if you subtract the first person, then it's about 1,000 fewer pages than if you just add it all up. Brzezinski didn't cooperate. He wasn't a flatterer of the media. He wasn't a cultivator of his image. He was a difficult, argumentative personality who fell out a lot with the media and didn't cooperate. Therefore, there are no biographies of him. And he is one of the two sort of great Cold War grand strategists, along with Kissinger, after George Kennan, who comes, you know, decades earlier, really, at the beginning. And there's no serious biography for him. And his life is cinematic, really, in terms of being born in interwar Warsaw, something that, you know, would very much strike a chord with you. And ending, you know, born in the year Stalin really takes control of the Soviet Union, and dying early 2017, a few weeks into Trump's presidency. As a nonfiction writer, a biography is as close as you get to the narrative form of fiction. So there is that side to it too. But mostly it's that he's a grand strategic thinker, whether you agree with him or not, who deserves a serious big biography like this.
Well, Ed, thank you for writing that big biography. We'll have you back to talk about it. And thank you so much for all of your insights today.
Always a pleasure, Yasha. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like, rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license. Thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.